Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Mecklenburg County decides on a new county manager to replace retiring Dina DiOrio. Departing Charlotte City Councilman Tariq Bakari on his way to the Trump administration holds his final town hall and endorses his wife to replace him. No hate crime charge will result from the recent incident involving two students at Ardrey Kell High School. We have details on that. Plus, rain puts a damper on wildfires in the mountains, and a statewide no-burn ban has been lifted. And here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE News climate reporter Zach Turner. Nick Oxner is chief investigative reporter for WBTV. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. And Joe Bruno joins us from the conference room at WSOC-TV, where he is also a reporter there. Thank you all for being here. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Mike.
After a nationwide search, Mecklenburg County commissioners announced they have found a replacement for the retiring Dina DiOrio, and just as they did when they chose her, they found her replacement in the House. Who did they name, Joe?
They named Mike Bryant, a longtime county employee who is currently serving as deputy county manager.
And he was the unanimous choice of the commissioners, and he has the endorsement of his boss, Dina DiOrio, who on Monday or Tuesday night, I've forgotten which, sang his praises.
He loves feedback, and he takes feedback well, and he acts on it appropriately. And so I think that's one of the things that makes him so successful, is that he wants to learn, he wants to grow, and he wants to be better.
Like DiOrio before him, he's been with the county for a while, I believe since 2003 when he was hired as a budget analyst. He's now the deputy county manager for financial services and internal support. And as we heard, Dina has high praise for him. Was she in on the search?
This was driven by the board of commissioners. Dina DiOrio had an outside role, if any.
Bryant will come on board at a time when the economy is turning a corner, possibly heading into recession thanks to recent moves by Donald Trump, and at a time when budget pressures might increase because of federal funding cuts. And the county's funds are already tight. Commission Chair Mark Durrell has speculated about another property tax increase coming, but Bryant told commissioners he intends to be, quote, responsive to whatever comes down the pipeline from the federal and state government and use it as an opportunity to become an even stronger organization. Did he explain how, Nick, in the face of all of that?
Sorry, I could not unclick mute fast enough. No, I don't believe we have gotten a detailed plan.
I just took a little nap there. Don't worry about it. I'm fine. At Tuesday's county commission meeting, Mike Bryant promised commissioners that he would serve all of the county's residents.
And I would do that with the highest level of integrity and the greatest level of professionalism. Thank you.
So Dina DiOrio has held this job for 11 years. A lot of people who live here have only known Dina DiOrio as the county manager. And she is, I like her because she's tough, but fair. And she speaks her mind, doesn't really pull a lot of punches. So how will his style, do you think, differ from hers?
Yeah, no, I'm a big Dina fan for the reasons you just mentioned. You always know where you are, where you stand with Dina. Yeah, you're exactly right. She is really all anybody knows is county manager for a lot of people who've moved here. Mike Bryant, I've known him as well for several years now. He certainly doesn't have the same demeanor as Dina DiOrio. He doesn't strike me as someone who is, I don't want to say looking for a fight, but, aggressive in that manner. I do know that the county workers view him as a fellow worker, almost like somebody who has come through the ranks of county government. He is extremely well qualified. He was in charge of the budget for a number of years as well. So he's kind of the perfect guy to be taking over as county manager during all of this, this period of transition with Mecklenburg County finances.
Yeah. So he begins his job on July the 1st. She will retire on June 30th. So more to come. We spoke about another impending departure last week when Charlotte City Councilman Tariq Bakari announced that he would be going to Washington to take a job as the deputy of the Federal Transit Administration within the Department of Transportation. And this week he held a final town hall with constituents. Unlike some Republicans, he likes doing town halls. In fact, he said he was a little sad that this one would have to be his last one. Joe, how many people showed up? What did he have to say?
You know, it wasn't like town hall that Chuck Edwards had last month or a couple weeks ago when, you know, the room was packed and overflowing with people. But the purpose of the town hall was to really let residents of District 6 know updates on crime, downzoning, the Unified Development Ordinance, single-family zoning, and infrastructure projects in South Park. And then, of course, it had this extra flair of him saying, this is my last one, and I'm heading to Washington.
So one thing he did was throw his support to his wife, Krista Bukhari, to finish out his term in that District 6 council seat. Council has to appoint a Republican by law to take over that seat. Is she then the shoe-in?
I would not call her a shoe-in. I think she might be considered a front runner. I think it remains to be seen if she'll clear the field. Certainly, you know, there aren't a whole lot of places that Republicans can get elected in the city of Charlotte. District 6 is one of those places they can. So this is a rare opportunity if there's a Republican who lives in that district to take a shot at the seat. And certainly there are a number of qualified Republicans who live in that district. However, I think Tariq Bakari's endorsement and new position, as well as Krista Bakari's qualifications and background, give her a significant leg up. And now she just needs to work on getting 6 votes from Charlotte City Council.
At that town hall meeting, Tariq Bakari told people that he believed she was the best person for the job. Of course, he didn't say that, then he couldn't go home. But did he say why, other than the obvious?
Well, I mean, she intimately knows the work. She was a former state house candidate. She does have relationships in Raleigh, like Tark has as well. She knows the district. And she also has been putting in work. She's done work with CMPD. She's organized fundraisers. She got passionate about infrastructure improvements after a tragic incident where a driver crashed into her and significant injuries happened as a result. So she knows she would be able to hit the ground running if she is appointed to this seat.
And as she also ran unsuccessfully for a seat at the in the North Carolina House last year. So she does obviously have political ambitions. Whoever gets this seat, however, will only hold it through December because new council elections will take place in November. In the past, Joe, when these vacancies have cropped up in between elections, some on council have tried to insist that the people taking those seats temporarily would promise not to run for re-election. Has that happened this time?
They have not said that yet, but some council members I've talked to have openly said, like, we need to figure out if we are going to express our desire for that to be the case. Certainly nothing is preventing whoever gets appointed from running. They can do so. Dimple Ejmyra kind of did that when she was appointed to District 5 and then ran at large. So if whoever gets appointed wants to, they can. I think that if, you know, just knowing how council operates and their preference for appointing a temporary member, somebody who'd be able to hit the ground running, I have no idea if he's interested. I haven't talked to him, but like, let's just say Kenny Smith all of a sudden wanted to come back. That's the kind of person that they in years past have appointed. Like Greg Phipps got appointed to the at-large seat because he knew the work and they knew it would be a temporary role for him. So, they like the idea of appointing somebody who can just hit the ground running, but not express an interest in the seat in the future.
Why in the past have they made that stipulation? Is it simply because they don't want to put the crown of incumbency on somebody and give them an unfair advantage at re-election?
Yeah, you're exactly right. And, you know, I think there's politics at play here too. You know, they don't necessarily want to endorse someone when they may have other friends who run for the seat. I think the dynamics are a little different with a Republican appointment because they don't have to worry about the primary, but I'm sure they are also somewhat thinking about who the Democrat in this race will be running against. And, you know, the Democrats do want this seat. It would be their benefit to have this seat, even though they have a supermajority on city council.
So
that's what I was thinking this whole discussion is, who, you know, the Republicans want to position someone who can actually challenge and defend this seat, because we know the last two races Beccari's won have been very tight. And so this is makes it an open seat for all intents and purposes, makes it even more of a toss up in the next election.
Do we know about her politics? Are they similar to Tariq's? Krista, are they similar? Are they the same? Or do we have any idea?
From my understanding, they are generally the same. I'm not sure municipal-wise, you know, because she ran for a state house seat, so not all of the questions and positions align necessarily directly. I do know she wasn't totally opposed to the sales tax increase when she ran for the state house. And she also significantly outperformed Trump in her district. So there was some Democratic support when she ran in that state house race.
So there is speculation that once Tariq Beccari is in his job in Washington as the number two transit official at DOT, that his presence might help Charlotte find funding for its transit ambitions. What, if anything, has he said about that?
He's kind of said like it's too soon to talk about specifics with his job and what he will or will not do. Also, you know, we still are kind of far away from that being a problem. I think that's a problem the city would love to have. Right now, they really need to focus on getting the option to have that referendum this fall.
So you talked to Mayor Vi Lyles about what his ascension to the Trump administration might mean for Charlotte.
I believe everything helps with the transit plan. Mobility is what we're going to do. This is, and I think he's been a part of this, and you know, he's helped us to be more consistent in what we were doing and to make some steps forward.
But at his Monday town hall, Tariq Beccari told constituents that he remains deeply conflicted, his words, over the city's plan to overhaul its transportation system. Still, the only other Republican on council, Ed Driggs, was optimistic about what he might be able to do for us.
We're penciling in about $5 or $6 billion of federal support that we hope to get. So Mr. Beccari in his new role could be instrumental in helping us access all the right people and getting the best application process we can.
And when you asked Ed Driggs, Joe, about Beccari's misgivings about our transit plan, here's what he said.
Mr. Beccari has been outspoken with observations about the plan. I don't think he was fundamentally in opposition to it. I think there were things that he disagreed with.
So we've made changes to our transportation plan to please the General Assembly. Would we have to make more changes to please Beccari if we expect him to grease the skids in Washington?
Potentially. You know, Steve Harrison had a great article last week that kind of questioned the timing over whether Charlotte will even be ready to present a lot of these ideas to Washington during Trump's term here over the next 4 years. We're talking about a 30-year plan. Certainly, I think that it would be wise for city council to involve Tariq more than they have.
You know, if they keep putting this transit plan off and keep putting off asking for all the things they need to get it started, we're not going to need the trains. We'll have flying cars by then. He announced that his last day on – has he announced what his last day on council will be?
No, not yet. He hasn't submitted his formal letter of resignation.
Okay. When we come back, an update on the Ardrey Kell fight between two students a couple of weeks ago and fires in the mountains where they stand, and also Hurricane Helene relief money. Is it being doled out? We'll talk about that when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Zach Turner, our climate reporter for WFAE News. He's on in just a moment to talk about wildfires in the mountains. Nick Oxner joins us. He's the chief investigative reporter from WBTV. We've been hearing a lot from Joe Bruno, who reports for WSOC-TV, and Mary C. Curtis is with us. She's a columnist at rollcall.com, host of their Equal Time podcast. So we reported several weeks ago on an altercation between a female and a male student at Ardrey Kell High School. The girl involved alleged she was being bullied by the boy, and the family of the girl, who was in fact badly injured in all of this, alleged that the boy targeted her because she was Muslim. They demanded that he be charged with a hate crime. And this week, CMPD announced their decision. They will not charge him with a hate crime. Nick, why not?
Well, they said the evidence didn't exist to meet the criteria. And, you know, there are specific elements of what constitutes a hate crime. I think there, you know, have been a lot of questions about the facts of what actually happened and how this actually happened. Of course, CMPD kind of muddied the waters by trying to punt this to the FBI, from whom we have not heard. Notably, we've heard again from CMPD, who said they investigated this themselves. And this continues to be a situation where we don't know a ton. It's hard to get a lot of concrete information ourselves because of student privacy laws.
So a hate crime has to be based on some kind of a prejudice against religion, race, or ethnicity. And the girl's parents say she was targeted for bullying because she was a Muslim, and as you said, the police say they found no evidence of that. Prior to that announcement, the family of the boy allegedly involved in all of this released a statement claiming that it was the girl who was the one doing the bullying and that she was the one who started this altercation. Does CMPD know precisely what happened? And if so, have they said anything about this?
I mean, I don't believe that we've gotten a detailed minute-by-minute account of what happened and how this happened. You know, the most recent information we have, of course, is just CMPD saying this wasn't a hate crime. You know, I think it's notable. I believe both students involved here faced disciplinary action. And we know in the past from Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools, that doesn't always mean that both sides are culpable. But that's certainly someone believes that in this case.
Neither student involved in this has been identified because they're both minors. Both students, however, I believe, were suspended immediately in the aftermath of that. Are those suspensions over? And does this decision by CMPD not to charge this as a hate crime end this?
I would think it does. You know, we heard it from the Muslim students' family again yesterday, who kind of questioned the validity or and the thoroughness of the CMPD investigation, but I don't think there's much more to do here. They could always file a lawsuit in court if they want to challenge that, and that's certainly their right.
All of North Carolina in the last couple of weeks has been under a no-burn order because of dry conditions and because of windy conditions, but we finally got some rain in places this week, and that ban has been lifted. However, there are certain restrictions, certain areas as to where that burn ban persists. Where are those? What conditions have to exist for you to not be able to lift the burn ban? Zach?
Oh, so for you to have this burn ban in place, you mean you're basically looking at some factors in terms of wind conditions and relative humidity. If you're in these long-standing drought conditions, if you have a lot of available fuel, then you're going to see these burn bans in place to prevent the spread or starting of another wildfire.
So the state initially had a burn ban. They mandated it, but now they're putting it in the hands of local authorities. What is the situation in local authorities can make a decision for the locality that they're in right now? So what is the major decision in this region? Have they been lifted here too?
Right now, as it stands, so the big fire that we've been looking at and kind of tracking over the last couple of weeks has been the Black Cove Complex fires, this combination of the Black Cove fire, the Deep Woods fire, and the Fishhook fire. Those have been mostly contained at this point, as well as the Table Rock Complex fire that was burning up from South Carolina and kind of touched into North Carolina a little bit. But we still have some ongoing blazes going on, I think, in Swain County and Haywood County as well at the moment. So all throughout Western North Carolina, it just kind of depends where we're seeing these burns pop up. But like you said, we've had these recent rains, and so the likelihood of having more of these blazes is decreasing, and so you're seeing less of these burn bans.
So these fires in the mountains are being fueled in part by debris left over from Hurricane Helene, but changing climate patterns, more droughts, windier conditions brought on by climate change are adding to the problem. Talk about that.
Absolutely. I mean, as our climate continues to warm, that's more energy that's in the atmosphere, which translates to higher winds more generally. And an ongoing trend that we're seeing in much of the United States in general is lowered humidity. As our climate continues to warm, it looks like the predictions are that North Carolina will likely see more severe droughts in the future, which is a big contributor to some of those conditions that lead up to wildfires. Basically, what you need to have a wildfire are three things: that ignition source, kind of tinder, and, you know, that's sort of what you're kind of looking for there. And those conditions are exacerbated as our climate continues to warm.
And every area of the country, I suppose, that are prone to wildfires, the fire season has been moving earlier and earlier and getting longer and longer. That is the case in California, and it evidently is the case here too. Governor Josh Stein, speaking with Blue Ridge Public Radio, says this year's early fire season is worse than normal.
What we pray is that this does not portend to a terrible summer, but there is a lot of fuel on the ground. As you said, so many trees are down and they've been on the ground and they're drying, making them timber, essentially. And so we have to do a good job clearing the roads and the forests so that when there are fires, the firefighters can move and get to where they need to do to cut off the fires.
Adding to that, the governor says there aren't enough firefighters available to do the work or to make that part of our state more resilient to future fires.
We need many more Forest Service employees. I've called for in my budget to the General Assembly for them to be able to hire dozens and dozens more firefighters. We have to raise the pay because there are too many vacancies. And we need to continue to have coordination. That's the main role that my office can play with our state emergency response team. We partner with the Forest Service, North Carolina Forest Service, the U.S. Forest Service, the state fire marshal, and then, of course, all of the local area firefighters when these do pop up, to figure out how do we attack it and do our level best to save property and life.
He says we have to fill those vacancies. Zach, how many vacancies are there and what is the contributing factor to them?
Not sure an exact number on those vacancies, but having those recent firings in the U.S. Forest Service has just diminished the pool of workers that you have available. When I was talking to Mountain True's Josh Kelly, who's a forestry expert there, he had mentioned that while none of the folks that were fired at the U.S. Forest Service were explicitly firefighters, they all had some of that fire management training. And so that just kind of reduces the amount of people that you have available in the region to respond to these wildfires when they happen. On top of that, you've got all of the storm debris that's making it more difficult for the number of firefighters that you have to access the perimeters surrounding these blazes.
So backing up, in February, as most of us remember, the Forest Service and the Park Service got rid of a lot of probationary employees. They were terminated by DOGE and by the Trump administration. Including about 17 employees working for the North Carolina National Forests. Here's what Mountain True's Josh Kelly, here's how he explained it to you when he spoke to you.
None of the people that were laid off were firefighters by job description, but almost all of them had firefighter training and worked on fires when needed. So you're reducing the pool of people available to help fight fires.
So help me understand this. If none of these people laid off were actually people that they send out to fight the fires, why are their layoffs hurting efforts to fight fires?
It's a number of reasons, too, because these are people that are in charge of also kind of doing prescribed burns on federal land. We've got a lot of national forests out there in Western North Carolina. And so having these folks able to do fuel reduction, getting those trees that were felled during Hurricane Helene out of the way before they can dry out and become additional fuel is essential to making sure that you don't have more dangerous, more severe blazes down the road. So while they're not trained necessarily as firefighters to like go and drive these engines, they are playing an important role in terms of reducing the amount of fuel available to these wildfires before they happen. And then during that response, when you have one of these wildfires that's spreading, when you have these bad conditions like drought, like high winds, that's just less people that you have to cut those fire lines and kind of get through a lot of that debris, which is creating these enormous access issues for folks working to manage these fires.
Mary.
Yeah. And as Zach was saying, the lines in these jobs, you just really, they aren't that exact. The layoffs at FEMA, at the National Weather Service, all of these federal jobs, including the Forest Service, but in these other agencies will have an effect on prediction and, you know, fire prevention and all of these things. So we don't know yet all the collateral damage that's happening from the cuts across different federal agencies. And unfortunately, we probably won't know the full effect until there is another weather disaster, another weather event, a fire, a flood. And then we'll see, oh, okay, the folks that worked for FEMA, that worked with the National Weather Service, that worked with the Forest Services, they all did something to alleviate the problem.
Zach.
And going back, I guess, to some of the access issue as it relates to these U.S. Forest Service workers that were fired, like they were working on projects to get infrastructure that was damaged by Helene that's on federal property, you know, back intact. So, and a lot of those roads are going to be essential for folks in the Forest Service and the North Carolina Forest Service, for firefighters to be able to access the perimeter of these fires. They're also a big part of how we get money that's being channeled from the federal government into these communities in North Carolina. So without them, you're trying to fit like a rock size, you know, amount of funding down a straw of personnel that is just not big enough to accommodate.
As was the case with other layoffs throughout the federal government resulting from DOGE, many of them were rolled back. Many of the people were rehired, and that is the case here. But Josh Kelly with Mountain True told Blue Ridge Public Radio that even though some of those laid off still had their equipment, these layoffs lead to a lot of change, which takes time to sort through. And this is at a time when they're facing all these things with regard to fire season and cleaning up brush, etc. And he pointed out that a lot of the houses in the mountains were not built to withstand the wind and rain brought on by these new, stronger, wetter hurricanes. Here he is.
Not everybody is 25 years old with a chainsaw and a bunch of friends that can help clear out the downed trees around their house. And there are a lot of houses in Western North Carolina that were built without any thought for fire. And even without Helene, those houses are still at risk.
So shortly after these layoffs, U.S. Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins was asked about the impact that these layoffs would have. And he said, quote, if at any moment anything comes up that is potentially compromising to this state and to our Forest Service's ability to fight these fires effectively, we will immediately put those people back in place. Would that even be possible?
I don't know about possibility. I think it's you're already trying to do a pretty impossible task to begin with, just in terms of triaging, you know, the number of projects that needed to be done in Western North Carolina, having people be laid off and then rehired and go back through that onboarding process is only going to make it more difficult.
100 days into his stint as governor, Josh Stein has been talking a lot about rebuilding, about federal aid, and the long road ahead after Hurricane Helene. The governor says trying to help those affected has been his number one priority. The General Assembly finally passed a bill authorizing $500 million in relief money for Western North Carolina about a couple of weeks ago. So far, they have allocated more than $1 billion to that effort. Some programs have completely spent their portion of that money, but it was reported this week that about $750 million remains unspent. Nick, why?
It's not entirely surprising. You know, we're only just over 6 months out from the storm. We're less than that from this money being appropriated. I think some context is needed here when you look at stories like this and numbers like this. The way we recover from hurricanes involves and other disasters involves a lot of bureaucracy. That requires a lot of red tape, a lot of hoops to be jumped through, a lot of boxes to be ticked before money can actually be spent. And in some cases, if you don't properly tick all those boxes before spending the money, you actually end up owing the money back. So we have to strike a balance here. And I hate to defend the government, which I know is unusual for me on this program. But, you know, here, this is not the period of time at which we should be saying, calling it slow yet.
Well, Jonathan Krebs is Governor Stein's Western North Carolina recovery advisor. He says some of that unspent money is set aside to be matched by the federal government, but because FEMA has been covering most expenses up to now, that money has not been needed.
A lot of this is kind of working through its process, and some of these funds are intended to be spent over the course of a year or over 18 months. And so there may be reasons for specific delays and why all of the funds aren't expended, you know, here as we stand today.
But as you said, Nick, that doesn't necessarily tell the whole story. Our colleague Colin Campbell at WUNC in Chapel Hill reports that $10 million allocated in October to help child care facilities to recover and get up and running was not parceled out until February 25th. Also, some things were set aside to make loans to small businesses and to local governments. And Krebs says that many of these entities have been reluctant to take on that debt. Is that unusual in times of crises?
Well, we saw a need for small business funding immediately after the hurricane, and the Small Business Administration was virtually out of money, and so this was a gap that the state was trying to fill. My guess would be, I'm just speculating here, but my guess would be that either they filled the gap too late so that some of these businesses were out of business now, or that, you know, they found other means of funding to stay afloat. But again, when you're talking about, you know, 3 or 4 months from appropriation to spend in government spending terms, that's actually fairly quickly. And I mean, contrast that with how we've recovered or not recovered from Hurricanes Matthew and Florence, and look at, we still have tens of millions of dollars sitting unspent from that. Obviously, that is slow. And I think it's because of the state's mishandling that we're on edge for that to happen here in Hawaii.
And is this why a lot of people in that area are complaining that they're not getting the relief that they need simply because of the red tape and the time it takes? I have 10 seconds.
Yes.
Okay. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more in a moment, including information about a social media bill going through the House. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. It's the local news roundup. I'm Mike Collins here with Zach Turner, our climate reporter at WFAE News, Mary C. Curtis, columnist for RollCall.com, host of their Equal Time podcast. Joe Brun is a reporter for WSOC-TV, and Nick Oxner, chief investigative reporter for WBTV. North Carolina State Senate Republicans chose a new majority leader this week, Senator Michael Lee of New Hanover County is their man to replace Senator Paul Newton, who resigned to become the general counsel at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. That makes Michael Lee the Mitch McConnell, John Thune of the state Senate. Does he wield that kind of power, Nick?
In the state Senate, there is one person who yields power above all others, and that is Senator Phil Berger, the longtime Senate President Pro Tem, who just carries on the fine tradition of the Democrats, Democrat leaders before him. But it is notable. So, you know, Mark Bassnight was a longtime Senate President Pro Tem under the Democratic reign before Berger and company ousted their control of the Senate. It is notable that when Bassnight was in the job, he had a very strong and stable lieutenant, a guy named Tony Rand from my hometown of Fayetteville. And Berger has not had a Tony Rand as he has run the Senate and functionally the state for more than a decade now. So it is interesting to see yet another changeover. Michael Lee is a longtime senator. He's from a very politically tough district. I think he lost re-election at one point, won his seat back again. And so this isn't a particularly surprising pick, I wouldn't say.
Well, he joined, Michael Lee, joined Phil Berger as the primary sponsor of a bill to ban DEI in schools, and which would prohibit local school districts from having DEI offices or from teaching students what the bill defines as, quote, divisive concepts or engage in, quote, discriminatory practices. In an op-ed that he wrote recently, he said the bill was not about, quote, stifling diversity or ignoring history. Rather, it is about reinforcing the core American values of fairness, merit, and the right to independent thought. Mary, both sides of the political divide have absolutely diametrically opposed views of these moves against DEI. Why? Why such a diametrically opposed, divergent point of view on the same topic?
Because I think there's a basic misunderstanding, and I would say on the Republicans' part, what DEI actually is, that it in itself is not discriminatory, but that it was the remedy for centuries of exclusion and discrimination and inequality. And it seems when they say they want to go back to an ideal, I think they want to go back to a myth. And I think American history is much more nuanced than that. You can say that America was a great country and that it did things that were terrible, including enslavement and the treatment of the indigenous peoples. And I think that students can handle that. In fact, I think that if you try to paint this rosy picture, that students will be questioning you and will doubt you. And I don't think folks should have to be afraid of that, that we are a country of contradictions, because we're people of contradictions. And I do wish that the leaders of this state and many states throughout the years were as anxious to rid the discrimination as they are to actually do away with the remedies. That means, I guess, that anything that has to do with something Black or disabled or folks with different abilities or female is somehow objectionable.
But there's a fundamental disagreement here. People on the left view these as remedies. People on the right see them as unnecessary.
Well, I really think it's more objective than that when you had actual laws on the books that discriminated against citizens who were taxpaying people, but yet couldn't go to the libraries and the swimming pools and the theaters, including the New Carolina Theater that just opened, which didn't admit African-Americans until 1963, even though they were paying taxes for all of these things. So you can have certain disagreements around the edges, but the basic facts are the same.
Meanwhile, in the House, House Bill 301 is winding its way through that body. It would ban social media accounts for kids under the age of 14 and require parental permission for other young people. The bill would give social media companies 30 days to ban minors under 14 from creating accounts, require parental consent for kids ages 14 and 15, and would require deleting existing accounts that don't comply with those age requirements. Most social media platforms have set a minimum age of 13 for account holders. Cabarrus County Republican Jonathan Ullman sponsored the bill, talking about a child's mental health being as important as their physical health. And Jeff Zenger, a Forsyth County Republican, also one of the bill's sponsors, brings his personal experience to his reasoning for banning social media for tweens.
As a parent who has fought the battle of screen time with four kids who are now all in their 20s, it is a raging battle. And so the idea was to put something up that would be a backstop for parents so that they could help regulate this and help kind of stand with this battle.
I would think not a lot of people have heard about this bill yet, Nick, but what kind of reaction, if any, has this gotten from parents, from kids?
I don't know that it's gotten a lot of reaction writ large. And Mike, we should also say that this bill is introduced in the long session, which is a time at the General Assembly every 2 years where lots of proposals come forth, many of which never come to fruition. So, you know, while some version of this might become law one day, it may not at all. or it might become laws. We're talking about it today. But, you know, I think this is rooted in research that finds children end up spending more time on their devices on social media than they intend. And it's rooted in good-natured intent. But already we've seen some issues raised by the Retail Merchants Association that this could have an oversized impact on some services on the internet. So we'll see if this ever becomes law.
How would you enforce it? How would you know the real age of an account holder? And have any penalties been proposed along with this legislation?
Yeah, penalties have been proposed, with the North Carolina Department of Justice being the enforcement mechanism via lawsuit in state court, with penalties up to $50,000 for each violation. And then account holders who would be able to sue or have a right of action for up to $10,000 damages on a platform where they're knowingly allowed access. But, you know, this is the same question. The bill sponsors have pointed out we do this now for gambling websites and for alcohol-based websites, age verification. But I'll also remind you, at some point, folks have pointed out that this was the same kind of tack that lawmakers took against Pornhub and other pornographic websites that resulted in that site just shutting down access in North Carolina.
Yeah. Rayla Collins is with the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union in North Carolina. They believe this violates a child's constitutional rights.
The internet is our nation's primary marketplace of ideas, and social media's primary purpose is to allow users to speak.
So would this be legal? Would it be a violation of free speech?
I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, that was my radio shrug. Sorry.
Yeah, radio shrugs don't work, I got to tell you. You people
on
television.
Well, you have to call them radio shrugs out loud, yes.
We appreciated it, Nick.
Okay, as we all know, Republican Judge Jefferson Griffin has been contesting the victory of his opponent in the state Supreme Court race, Justice Allison help me out here. Her name
Riggs.
Has gone away.
Riggs.
Thank you. She won that race by 734 votes after two recounts, but he wants 65,000 votes disqualified, thrown out. The two are in the middle of a court battle to that end, but last weekend a wrinkle appeared. A photograph of a young Jefferson Griffin surfaced, evidently while studying at UNC Chapel Hill. In the early 2000s, his fraternity, Kappa Alpha, held an Old South ball at which its members, including Griffin, dressed up in Confederate apparel. Okay, should we care about this? This isn't blackface. It is true that some would find this distasteful. Others would find it just silly. Others may see nothing at all wrong with this and may view any attempt to disqualify him over a picture of him in a Confederate uniform at the age of 20 as another example of cancel culture. Mary, should we care? Should this be an issue?
That he valorized a time and a place that also disenfranchised a whole lot of people. I think it just says something about him. We're not talking about ages ago. Let's face it, Wake Forest disallowed this stuff in 1987. And here he is in the early 2000s, long since the time when people and fraternities and colleges were saying this might not be a good idea, belonging to Kappa Alpha Order, which is a fraternity that has gotten into a lot of trouble for things like this. And reporting has said that when they wanted to stop these kinds of hoop skirt Confederate balls, that he was one who was very much in favor of keeping it. So I think that it is fair game, if he's trying to disenfranchise all these voters, for us to look and see what kind of a person he may have been then. And he can apologize now, and that's all well and good. But the pictures show he's pretty darn happy to be there.
It was reported, I don't know if it's accurate or not, that the year after this picture was taken, he was leading the charge to ban Confederate flags from future balls as a part of this. But he issued a statement saying, over 20 years ago, I attended a college fraternity event that, in hindsight, was inappropriate and does not reflect the person I am today. I did not fully grasp the broad historical and social implications. There are some that would argue you're a college student, you should, but as we all know, you mature at different levels and you learn at different rates. In this group photo, about 30 young men are all in these Confederate uniforms. There are no rebel flags, no signs espousing racist slogans. The photo was obtained by the Associated Press, but someone had to alert them of its existence. Is this someone just trying to stir up politics during this fight over the court? Or is it another acknowledgement of an organization that has been described, as you point out, Mary, as a lightning rod for controversy for decades because of racist and insensitive action by some of its fraternity members? Where do you come down on that?
Like I said, it seems that we want to hold people accountable, some people, for things they do when they're young. But it seems that particularly for white men, that they are just boys will be boys. This is just something done, you know, youthful indiscretion. And the fact that he's in the news because of trying to overturn this vote for, I think it is, you know, we could look at it and everybody can make their own judgment about the person. Only he knows what he feels. But as I said, Kappa Alpha is a fraternity that you choose to join. And it does come with its own reputation. And this wasn't 100 years ago. This was 20 years ago.
25. Just as background, the AP reports that this fraternity claims Robert E. Lee, as its spiritual founder, has long supported the Lost Cause, which is a view of history that romanticizes the Confederacy and portrays the Civil War as a valiant struggle for states' rights, unrelated to the enslavement of black people. But also for background, because I've done many shows on this, the first paragraph of every article of secession from every state that seceded says that slavery was the primary reason for leaving the Union. That's the first in the first paragraph of all of them.
And Robert E. Lee has been debunked as not exactly a heroic person, but an incredibly cruel enslaver.
So even as the General Assembly seeks to ban North Carolina's Democratic Attorney General Jeff Jackson from using or from suing the Trump administration over executive orders, Jackson is suing them, joining a multi-state suit challenging the federal government's decision to cut more than $11 billion in health care funding nationwide. If that stands, how would that impact our state? Mary.
Well, yes. Jeff Jackson, the Attorney General, says $230 billion of health $230 million of healthcare dollars would be cut. The North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services says about $100 million and at least 80 jobs. And they say this will go into a lot of local health and human services offices, and it will include things like mental health services, addiction treatment, infectious disease studies, measles. We know that it's coming back, a measles study, all of these things. And you know, seniors and some of their health care needs. And so that's why Jeff Jackson, along with attorneys general from other states and also health care officials, are fighting these Trump cuts. And we see this happening all over the country. And particularly since RFK Jr. is now the head of the Department of Health and Human Services, they worry that the states will have to do a lot of picking up when it comes to these studies, because we know he's very skeptical of vaccines and other things. So that's why they're suing.
And this is Jeff Jackson's fifth lawsuit against the Trump administration in the last, 70 days or something like that.
Well, he calls himself a nonpartisan shield, right? And others say that he's partisan, but...
So I'm not sure, Joe, why this is news, because there seems to be a new traffic pattern every 10 minutes at the Charlotte Douglas International Airport. But this week, there's a new traffic pattern at the airport. What's the difference?
They are sending the Ubers and Lyfts upstairs to the arrivals. So no longer will they have to battle with the rest of traffic on the departures level. And it is a nightmare. It's always been a nightmare. And hopefully it goes from a nightmare to just a bad dream with these changes.
And Channel 9 reports that the airport's been working for months to try and stave off traffic congestion. Are their efforts showing fruit? Are they bearing fruit?
I guess. I mean, I don't think there's ever really an ideal time to pick up somebody from the airport or get picked up at the airport. I personally go to the hourly deck and get dropped off in there. You know, we'll see. Spring break's coming up. Good luck, everybody.
So I have 1 minute. It's Final Four weekend, and North and South Carolina have teams in those games. The University of South Carolina Gamecocks have their women's team led by Coach Dawn Staley. They will face the Texas Longhorns tonight at 7 in Tampa. Both teams are number one seeds. They've met three times this season, with Carolina leading that effort 2-1. Are we placing any bets tonight? Mary, You're the basketball.
No bets, but they're going to be good games. Not too many no Cinderella teams this year, but that means that we're probably going to get some hard-fought games with the four. And Duke is playing tomorrow, and South Carolina is playing on Friday.
There you go. We have covered the whole thing, the whole kit and caboodle. There's nothing left to talk about, except the five pages of stuff I have on the floor here. Zach Turner joins us. He's our climate reporter at WFAE News. Nick Oxner's chief investigative reporter for WBTV. Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSOC-TV. And Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time broadcast or podcast. And I should say that there was no extra charge today for the radio shrug from Nick. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. We have additional production help from Jesse Steinmetz. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.